Thanks, Don. And this is Regina's usual slot covering Nizar Gadatta. She has been using several of his books during the last 6 to 9 months. And the one that she wanted me to continue on is one she used last week. If you have a copy of it, it's Consciousness and the Absolute. Consciousness and the Absolute. And we are on page 10. The bottom of page 10, dated November 9th, 1980. And just a couple comments before I start. Nizar Gadatta, at this point in time, he already knew that he had throat cancer and didn't have that long for, as he would say, his food body to continue to remain here. And as he got older, particularly as he knew his time was short, he started sharing deeper truths. And one of his style, he had several different style points and that were unique to him. And Regina has pointed at least one of them out for sure. And that is his more challenging, aggressive style when asked questions and his purpose for kind of having that style, at least according to him, is that he had only one interest for people that visited him, and that was to help them wake up. So he felt that anyone that came to him needed to be challenged personally in regards to where they were at that particular day. And it's kind of interesting because you had people that would come back day after day and ask certain questions day after day. And on one day they would ask a question, he would give one answer. The next day he'd come back and say, yes, I pondered this. And he wouldn't give an answer. He would pose a question for them to ponder and kind of give them a hint of what that might be. And they would come back and said, yes, through my contemplation, I arrived at this, and I believe this is what you were saying. And then he would give them almost a totally different kind of response in regards to their contemplation, because he wanted to move them yet to the next level. So I think it's one thing to always keep in mind. The context of anything Nizar Gadatta says is in that loving, challenging mode, and also it's specific to the person he is speaking to. So we have to be a little careful about taking any statement he makes as kind of his general truth on things, because he's also known to have had people come to him that thought they were pretty smart, pretty enlightened. And he would tell them, you don't need to come. I hope you'll come tomorrow so I can be more enlightened by you. Which, of course, is just, him. And they would actually kind of believe it in a sense. But, he had no problem kind of playing the little games like that too, like kind of tongue in cheek. And he's also said on a number of occasions that he gets invited to speak at a particular group. And he goes, what am I going to talk about? If I talk about the truth, they may crucify me like Jesus, because they're not ready to accept the truth. And so I guess I'll have to talk about X, Y, and Z, which is, things that he would call it baby food or first grade teachings that at least would not, and that were understandable enough that people couldn't misinterpret them to take offense. So with that said, again, November 9th, 1980, questioner, should the type of dispassion which Maharaj is teaching us be taught to children? Maharaj, no. That if that's done, they'll have no ambition to grow further. They must have certain ambitions, certain desires for their proper growth. So what an interesting beginning to his answer. I can just speak for myself because I have children. The few attempts I have made to try to save them from themselves, to impart some little wisdom that may make the school of hard knocks not quite so painful, usually didn't work out so well. It's almost that they have their own path and they really have to find it on their own. And I think what's key here is, as we know, Nisargadatta's approach is really all about the I am, and catching hold of that and not letting it go, and tracing it back as it relates to who we think we are. And I would suggest that, you know, any child is already going to have experienced their own beginning of human conditioning and sense of what that is. And any attempt to try to teach them the truth would just be confusing, because they're not at a point where they can discern anything. So my sense is what he's trying to say is they need to grow. They need to grow further. They need to come to a point where they have discernment, so they for themselves then are at a place where they can maybe address these questions, ask these questions, and follow that trail themselves, which as children they're really not able to do. His further answer in the next paragraph is, the one who has fully investigated himself, the one who has come to understand, will never try to interfere with the play of consciousness. There is no creator with a vast intellect as such. All this play is going on spontaneously. There is no intellect behind it. So don't try to impose yours to bring about any change. Leave it alone. There is no creator with a vast intellect as such. Everything is going on spontaneously. There's no intellect behind it. You know, I think this is one of the areas that I found very challenging to begin with when I was first kind of introduced to this concept, because in my upbringing, there was this loving, caring creator. There was a persona that was imparted, that was given, and that I was taught to believe was part of what we call at that point God, the Father. And, you know, to the, I guess, I think it's the, not Hindu, but Buddhist concept of interdependent co-arising, that everything kind of is going on spontaneously, that nothing is a cause or effect of anything else. It just, there are millions of factors that have come into play over time to bring about me holding this in front of you. And it's just all happening spontaneously, and that God is such, if we want to use that term, and some people resonate with that, others don't. Some others use the word source or the absolute. And I don't think Nisargadatta would have an issue with whatever particular term somebody used, because he was also very sensitive to cultural background. And so whatever resonated most with a particular person, he never particularly turned them away from that. But what he would do is challenge them to say, your concept of your God, your source, might be a little different than my understanding. And obviously people are coming to him because they felt that he was enlightened and had deeper concepts to share. No intellect behind it at all. It's almost amorphous. I was trying to remember the name of the concept where God is in everything and somethingism. I can't remember right now. Anyway, I'm out of blank time. But, you know, it almost gets back to what Jesus said to some degree, that God as a sun to shine on the good and the wicked, that nothing's treated any differently. Everything is exactly the same for everyone. And that we have this almost this kind of common way of wanting to overlay ourselves onto any belief concept that we have. Our belief in God will tell us more about what we believe about ourselves than almost anything else. And I think sages and even ministers will say that you can tell the level of development at a particular country based on their concept of what God is. So us trying to superimpose ourselves and to bring about change is what he's warding against us trying to do, and just to accept that whatever is supposed to be exactly as it is, and not to try to say this is happening particularly because God loves, you know, Susie so much that, you know, she helped her find her cat. Or, you know, whatever it was, because I think, again, at least from his perspective, that's not a concept that he would particularly support. Your intellect is a subsequent product of this process. So how can your intellect take charge or even evaluate the whole creation? Investigate yourself. This is the purpose of your being. So I think what he's saying here is obviously whatever it was that created and caused this to be is at a higher level than you. So how could you ever be in a position to intellectually try to discern how this came about and try to explain it to somebody else? Because you're always going to fall short, and you're going to come up with a misunderstanding or misconcepts if you try to do so. Don't try to evaluate. The only thing that we really know, according to Nisargadatta Maharaj, is that we are. He always turns us back to ourselves, to look within. Doesn't tell us what we're going to find. It's always, and, you know, all the years that he did this, he was always held that back, which I think is just says so much about him, that he was pushing everyone to come to that concept on their own, that he felt that was really important. I think there's a saying by one of the Hindu gods, I think, that doing someone else's meditation perfectly is not anywhere as good as doing your own personal meditation imperfectly. So it's all about developing our own style, looking for our own style, and then ourselves looking within to see what we find, what we see. Spirituality is nothing more than understanding this play of consciousness. Try to find out what this fraud is by seeking its source. And this is one of the things I really love about him, because he just calls a spade a spade. He relates to this I-amness coming upon children at a certain kind of age. He doesn't give a particular age, but at some point when they see themselves separate, that basically they've been kidnapped and taken hostage by the I-am, who teaches them a bunch of things that's just not real. That's not accurate. And so he is very consistent and over pointing us back to understand how that fraud took place and what is going on. This is a play of consciousness. So I know Regina style is primarily just kind of what comes to her and kind of more of a teaching style. I'm very open to interaction as it relates to certain, not on anything as it relates to what I'm participating in. And so I'd be curious about how any of you relate to the statement that understanding that spirituality is nothing more than a play of consciousness. Because obviously we're all kind of in, for lack of a better term, seeking a higher spiritual understanding. Seeking the truth. Is seeking the truth considered spirituality? Is that the definition of seeking truth? I think it might be. And this play of consciousness, this fraud, try to find out the source of this fraud. Yes. Don. I can't. Are you still on mute?
I'm trying to mute button. That's hilarious.
There you go.
So earlier in my program, Coming Home to the Heart, I shared in exactly how that play plays out. As a child, one of my little idols was my mom, or just anyone who was in my life that took care of me. And it seems as for me, I want to speak for myself, but what happens is you just automatically believe them. Whatever they say, it's like truth or gold. Or I don't know about you, but as a child, I never questioned my mom and anything she said. Like if she said it, it was just like, that's just how it is. And especially parental figures, teachers, you know, I did really well in school and it's because I did what I was told. They said, do this. I did it to the best of my ability, what I was capable of. But as he's saying, the play of consciousness, what I can see is, for instance, the lie that I was believing was the lie. The exact belief was you hurt him. So for instance, if I were to play that out, in other words, everything that happens when I believe that particular thought, all these things could happen, from pushing people away, isolating, my behavior changes. If someone is loving to me, I'm not loving to them back. So do you see how that is a play? I've used my believing attention in such a manner as to cause a whole host of things to come about that's a dream, because it wasn't real. The first thought wasn't real. It wasn't truth. So by believing a lie, in this case, just that particular thought, three little words, you hurt him or I hurt him, is enough to cause a whole cascade of events to occur. Or just a particular attitude, way of being in the world, being towards myself, and feeding into that whole dynamic of separation, which is the guilt itself, the I am bad belief, which sets off a whole nother stream of things of how now I look at you, I look at anyone, because if I believe I hurt someone, I also believe with that is kind of a twin belief, you hurt me. So therefore, now I've set up another play, a world within a world within a world, of now there's victims and there's perpetrators. There's a me, there's a you, there's separation. You hear it? There, just those three little words, I created a whole world of separation where there's a victim, a victimizer, someone who's good, someone who's bad, all in three little words. But that happened upon something that miraculously almost occurs as a child of believing. It's like, you know, how we're watching a movie and we just get sucked in. It's just that same mechanism of we just get so into the movie. It's like you forget you're watching the movie. And I think a lot of it almost happens as a natural, maybe to think of a duck, you know how they imprint the first one they see, it's like this imprinting. Well, we had to survive, right? So you kind of want to fit in, so to speak, into your environment. So I feel like part of it, it's part of the evolution. And then we get to a certain point like we are now. We have a choice now. Back then it didn't seem so. But now we have a choice. Do I want to continue this belief, putting my believing intention to something that causes a whole array of a playing out of suffering? I mean, I shared in my program just this litany. There was just a whole list of all these things that would happen when I believed that thought. So I can see that is the practical way, or the way in which the play plays itself out, is anytime we put believing attention to any thought, even if it's a good thought, sometimes with the other one, you get the flip side of the coin. So in three little words can create a world. So
yeah. Absolutely. I think we have different layers of, you know, of this kind of fraud, this dream taking place. And that's clearly a layer I can relate to, what you just shared. Is there a different level, maybe even a deeper level? Consciousness as such is really at the second level. It's the second principle of God. You know, our level of form, an example you just gave, Don, was really at the fourth principle of God, at the level of form. But at the level of consciousness, understanding this play of consciousness, what's happening at that second level that has created kind of a fraud, you know, is there almost a sense that if everything's happening spontaneously and there's this interdependent co-arising, which doesn't leave a whole lot of room for free will, leave some, but not a whole lot of room. Are we mere puppets on a string if we've kind of bought into what's taking place? Okay, I see some head shaking going on. Come on, head shaker, you got something to say?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly what, thanks, Ron. I think you were talking to me because I sure was shaking my head.
Yes, I was.
I mean, it's what we've been doing a lot of talking about lately, what I understand folks are looking at in General Healing Year 3. And what I've been talking about, what Eshwar Sigovind was talking about the other night, you know, it's the way I've described it is, you know, this body-mind personality is a portal for consciousness to look through, to move, to use, to, you know, it's like you create a play by setting up a cast of characters, and then you introduce, I mean, this is how every novel's written, right? You create the character, and then you introduce a problem. You introduce a situation. Wonder how this character would react if this happens. Oh, that's really cool. Look how that character would react. And of course, the issue for us is that we think we actually exist. We think we're characters. We forget that we are the consciousness that just set all that in motion. Yeah, that's it.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess I relate to it best. And I think many of you have heard me. I kind of mentioned the movie Inception. Inception really has as part of its main plot that you have a dream within a dream, even within a dream. That it goes three levels and what's taking place. And it's really pretty fascinating. It's probably the best graphic example I've seen in that allows me to conceptualize a little bit of what might really be taking place. If consciousness itself has gotten caught up into the play and has its dream here on this level, are his dream creations are having their own dreams and making up exactly what Don was talking about. So this fraud, if that's the case, and we're seeking to live truth And I would suggest, at least from my perspective, the reason I'm always seeking to find and to live truth is I believe that all of us have a built-in homing device that is an imprint of the absolute. I relate to it almost as the DNA of the absolute. And that's home. We're not at home. And until we get there, we're going to be like you've seen these diagrams or videos where you have a magnet and you have these iron filings and you see the magnet, iron filings getting close to the magnet, they start to quiver and to shake, and then they will stay in that condition until there's enough pull to they actually join with the magnet. Well, we're right in that quivering vibrational state, and we're not going to be still until we join with whatever that truth is. No matter what kind of monetary success or accolades that we get, we're still not going to be at peace. I will never be at peace, to speak for myself, until I get there. So I'm actually kind of pragmatic about it. It's kind of like, well, bottom line, I'm going to get there anyway, one way or the other. So I'd rather make that journey a little more pleasant than, going through too many additional editions of the School of Hard Knocks, which isn't always so pleasant. So fraud. Try to find out what this fraud is by seeking its source. So Nisargadatta talks about this quite a bit in other areas. And the tracing back that he refers to, and I would leave you with as we're kind of winding down on our time, is trace back from our childhood mentally, not that you're particularly trying to visualize and be in that space, but you can, I guess there's no rules to this, to the birth canal, to being in the womb, to conception, but more importantly, before conception. Because if in fact I am consciousness was before conception took place, and I am, or consciousness, will still exist when this food body decomposes at a ripe old age, then what is before? And where and how did the fraud take place? He talks about that he's the unborn and he was before the unborn, and asks us actually to trace back to what does unborn mean? What is the unborn? I kind of have my own personal answers, but I think Nisargadatta was very clear that it's not for us to share what those are, that it's for each of us to find what that is for ourselves. And as Regina would say, once you get to the source, then you can go beyond the source. And the reason that we need to first get to the source, we first have to get to the source. We have to understand what took place to be able to get to the source before we can go beyond the source. So the paradoxes that we deal with, when one hand where Regina or Nisargadatta will say that consciousness is a fraud and isn't real too, is true in a sense. But in another sense, it's something we have to experience and go through. So it's very real. And it's very true from that perspective. And it's something that it's a stage that we must go through before we can go beyond. And that's just one of those paradoxes there are many. So again, I would just leave you with his words that try to find out. Spirituality is nothing more than understanding this play of consciousness. Try to find out what this fraud is by seeking the source of the fraud. So contemplate that in your time if you can, in meditation, and see what arises. thank you for the opportunity. I thank Regina for allowing me to sit in. And again, as always, I'm honored to sit in the chair of the teacher, but more so your student and your friend. Thank you.